This is the podcast of Vermont Edition, a production of Vermont Public Radio. The program and this podcast are made possible by the financial support of our listeners. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. There's a big difference between earning minimum wage and making enough to live comfortably or even to make ends meet. Many Vermonters struggle while making much more than the minimum wage. Lee Russell is a 66-year-old widow who works as a receptionist and moonlights weekends at Walmart.
I work 7 days a week. I was payroll administrator at Stanley Works in Shasbury for 27 years. And when they closed, I went from $16 an hour down to $6.25 an hour. So you do what you need to do to keep what you got. You don't go out for dinner a lot. You don't have a large recreation life because you just can't afford it.
Kevin Gallagher works at Leonardo's Pizza in Burlington.
I'm 26. Most of my friends have graduated college and gone on to have, you know, lives by now. My intent is to do the same at some point. I would like to get out of this minimum wage world. But the way it seems to me is that there's probably 45 other people who are going to take my spot who probably might not be willing or able to get out of the minimum wage world. So even though I don't plan on being here forever, it really bothers me of how hard it is to live with it.
All this week on Morning Edition, VPR is presenting stories of Vermonters who are working hard but just barely getting by or falling behind. Today on Vermont Edition, we'll explore some of the policies and root causes behind this struggle, and we'd like to hear from you as well. You can email us at vpr.net or give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That is, you can go online to our website at vpr.net. Our direct email is vermontedition@vpr.net. Colin Robinson joins us now. He's the director of the Vermont Livable Wage Campaign. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what's the difference between minimum wage and livable wage?
Well, the basic difference is a livable wage is a wage that one needs to support themselves, to meet their basic needs, those basic necessities of life that we all have to pay for, including housing, transportation, fuel, childcare if you have children, food, clothing, and those things that you really can't live without. And so it's a wage that allows someone to pay and afford all of those needs. Now, a minimum wage, of course, is the wage that kind of sets the base, the wage floor for all wages in society. And right now that there's a difference of about half, the minimum wage about half of what a livable wage for a single person in Vermont would be.
And a livable wage for a single person is somewhat over $14.
Yep, a livable wage in Vermont, we have numbers, livable wage numbers for both rural and urban. The only area in Vermont that is considered urban is Chittenden County. And that average number for an individual is $14.54 an hour in 2008. And that includes employer-sponsored health insurance.
So that's not paying for health care at all. That is just the amount you need to live on to pay all of your other basic needs.
It assumes the employer pays 84% of your health insurance costs. But as we know, a lot of folks don't have health insurance these days.
How do you come up with those numbers?
Well, the history of the numbers is they're actually calculated by the Joint Fiscal Office of the state legislature every 2 years. The most recent numbers were calculated in March of 2007, and they came out of a summer study group back in 1999 that set up a very specific methodology for looking at what costs Vermonters are facing and what are those market costs for those needs. And so every 2 years, the Joint Fiscal Office comes out with the Basic Needs Budget Report, and based on different family scenarios, individuals that are single parents, families with one wage earner, two wage earners, they say this is a wage that that family needs to support themselves. Every year in the odd years, we adjust that by the Consumer Price Index, which is the same amount that the Vermont minimum wage goes up every January 1st.
Now, who are we talking about? Can you put sort of a face to the numbers here? Who are the Vermonters who are making less than a livable wage?
Well, if you look at the actual numbers, they're 1 in 4 working Vermonters make less than a livable wage. And, you know, we're talking about folks that are working in what one would normally consider good jobs. You know, as we heard on VPR this morning, Donna Olson is a paraeducator up in Milton. And, you know, that's what we would think is a good job. And you know, and as Lee and Kevin were speaking to, you know, these are jobs that people are working hard for. And so we're talking about, you know, paraeducators, food service workers, custodians. One of the other ones is folks working in our seasonal industries, ski areas, where folks are you know, obviously kind of at the mercy of the weather. But at the same time, as we know, that the ski industry and the tourism industry, the service-based economy in Vermont is so integral. And without those jobs and without that economy, we would be in a lot harder place. But unfortunately, those jobs don't pay a livable wage.
And are we talking mostly about young people just entering the workforce, older people? Is there a range of ages?
Well, there is a range of ages. And, you know, according to the population, the current population survey from 99 to 2001, that's the most recent numbers I found, actually 60% of people making over $8 an hour were over 30 years old. So, you know, folks who are working these low-wage jobs aren't, you know, high school students. Of course, some of them are, but the majority are not. The majority of them are hardworking Vermonters who are maybe having to piece together two or three jobs to be able to meet their basic needs.
Well, Colin Robinson, how do people meet those needs? I mean, if they're not making a livable wage, if they're making, say, close to the minimum wage of $7.68, how do they survive?
Well, there are a couple ways. One, as I just said, they'll work multiple jobs, and so they'll piece together different employment opportunities. They'll also rely on public assistance, which is a very, very important safety net that we have in our society. But one of the biggest problems is there is a cliff, and you know, an individual may be making $10 an hour and then get a raise of $1, and that's great. They're making $1 more an hour, but maybe because of that $1 raise and their family situation, they're no longer eligible for food stamps, or that Section 8 voucher isn't going to come through this time, or their VHAP application is going to be rejected, and they're actually worse off than they were before because there's that cliff in public benefits. One of the other big areas where folks make up the difference, and this was also alluded to in some of the folks that you've spoken with, is credit cards. People put a lot of stuff on plastic, and we're unfortunately seeing the ramifications of that in our economy now. But it is a situation where when folks aren't able to meet their basic needs, they either, you know, work more, they're already working pretty hard, they put it on plastic, or as Lee was saying, they go without.
Now, this has been a problem, obviously, for many years. We've been talking about minimum wage for years now. The minimum wage has been around for, you know, 80 years. What kind of trends are you seeing, and do you think that we're making improvements?
Well, I do think that we are making some improvements. Obviously, here in Vermont, we have the fifth highest minimum wage in the country, and it goes up every single January 1st with the cost of living, the Consumer Price Index. And, you know, that's great. And, you know, it's exciting to see that progress. But at the same time, recognizing that there are other factors and other ways we measure how folks are doing in our society, one of them being the way a lot of these public assistance programs are figured out is based on the federal poverty limit. And the federal poverty limit is an incredibly antiquated measure of what it truly costs to live. And so you have a situation where somebody could be making, you know, $8.50 an hour, but if they're a single parent with two children, they're still coming in at 100% of the federal poverty limit. We have a situation where a minimum wage is setting people up to be in a situation where they're never going to be able to support themselves, and they're at 100% of the federal poverty limit of a measure of poverty that we know is out of date. And, you know, that's why it's great we see programs like Catamount and Dr. Dinosaur going up to 300% of the federal poverty limit, because that's the reality Vermonters are facing and folks across this country, that it costs more to live. And the wages aren't supporting folks as they need to be.
And what does the Vermont Livable Wage Campaign do to try to combat this?
Well, we're a project of the Peace and Justice Center in Burlington, and we've been around for about 11 years. And we have a kind of a multifaceted approach. Our history started with the job gap study, just presenting the numbers, saying, look, this is what it costs. And so there's that part, the policy, the job gap study, and there's been 9 different editions of that. We also do work in the state legislature. We've been the leading organization on the minimum wage increases over the past 10 years, and the most recent success being the tip minimum wage increase this past year. The tip minimum wage hadn't been increased in years.
And that's for people who work in restaurants and food service and tipping industries?
Exactly, exactly. And then the other two components of our work that are just as important, and yeah, I think even more so, one is education. We go around Vermont to high schools, to colleges, to community centers, and talk to folks about economic justice issues, about livable wages, and about, you know, these realities that they are often very, very familiar with. And the final component is doing some community organizing. We have worked most recently with the Burlington Pair Educators and the Burlington School Food Service Workers and Custodial Workers to try and get them a livable wage. And the Pair Educators were successful this past November, and the food service workers are still fighting that. And so we've had some localized organizing campaigns bringing low-wage workers together, using their collective and their community voice to advocate for better wages.
We're talking with Colin Robinson, the director of the Vermont Livable Wage Campaign, about what it takes to make a living here in Vermont. And we'd like to hear your thoughts on the matter. Are you struggling to make a livable wage? Are there shortcuts that you've learned that can make things easier? And what kind of economic policies do you think could help your situation? You can join our conversation by calling 1-800-639-2211, or you can email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. This is Vermont Edition.
Next time on Day to Day.
The stars.
The speeches.
Thank you. I'm so honored to thank the Academy.
There's nothing but glitz and glamour when you're at the Oscars.
So we got invited?
Direct from the nosebleed seats high atop the second mezzanine.
Our bird's eye view of the Academy Awards.
And the Oscar goes to...
Next time on Day to Day.
You can hear Day to Day weekdays at 2 o'clock. Following the story on VPR. VPR is funded by listeners like you and by VITA, Vermont's economic development lender since 1974, offering business loans, bonds, and loan guarantees at 828-JOBS. And Velco, Vermont Electric Power Company, celebrating over 50 years as Vermont's transmission reliability resource. Moving power, moving forward, velco.com. This is VPR, Vermont Public Radio.
I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. As part of VPR's week-long series, Getting By, we're talking about what it takes to make a living in Vermont. According to the Vermont Livable Wage Campaign, a single person with no children needs to earn more than $14 an hour in order to meet basic needs and pay taxes. And that's with employee-sponsored health insurance. But the minimum wage is just over half of that. We'd like to hear what you think about the matter. How close do you live to the margins? Are there policies that you would like to see changed? And are there enough resources out there to help you? Call us at 1-800-639-2211, or you can email us at vermontedition@vpr.net. We've been talking with the director of the Livable Wage Campaign, Colin Robinson, and now I'd like to introduce Art Wolf. He's an associate professor of economics at the University of Vermont and a principal in Northern Economic Consulting in Westford. Art Wolf, welcome.
Thank you, Jane.
Do you see a trend as an economics professor toward more people making less than what we're calling a livable wage?
No, actually, the trend is that we're actually getting richer. If you look over a long period of time, which you had a little bit of discussion about what were the trends over time, The average Vermont family does better and better each year as the economy grows, and that affects not just the rich and the middle class, but the poor as well. So economic growth really has benefited everybody, and our definition of poverty, of course, is a moving target. As a society gets richer, our idea of who's poor and what constitutes poverty also changes.
But we hear a lot about this widening gap between the rich and the poor. Is that true?
Well, there is evidence that there is this widening gap, what we should really be concerned about is, are the fruits of economic growth going to everyone? You can have a very narrow gap between rich and poor and have everybody be poor. China, for example, before the early 1970s, had a very equal distribution of income. There was no gap because nobody had anything. Now there's a very large gap between the rich and the poor in China. But the people at the bottom are better off than they were 30 years ago. And there's obviously a middle class that never existed before. And I use China not to change the tone of the talk, but we have to realize that as an economy grows, you can expect some widening of the income gap. The real question is what's happening to the people at the bottom, not really. I don't think anybody really cares what's happening to the people at the top as long as the majority of people are benefiting from economic growth.
Okay, so what's happening to the people at the bottom?
Well, the number of people or number of families in Vermont that are earning under $30,000 has been falling for the last 20 years. If we consider what poverty is like today compared to 30 years ago, the average poor family today owns a car, has a color TV, has a VCR. They've got the accoutrements of things that we consider to be very nice parts of life, whereas 30 years ago, people did not have VCRs and color TVs. So even at the very bottom of the income scale, people do benefit from economic growth.
Colin Robinson, what do you think? I mean, you're hearing that people are making more or having more than they did 30 years ago. So do you see less of a problem?
Well, I just want to kind of frame the conversation here because, I'm going to be speaking and everything I've been saying today is from experience and talking to Vermonters across the state. And obviously Art is a trained economist and has that perspective. But, I think the realities of working Vermonters are very different. And, the people on the top are the ones I think are benefiting the most. And, you look at the numbers and the percentage of growth in average household income over the past, 30 years or so has been concentrated on the top. But, the thing is, when we hear from Vermonters, and I think, as Lee and Kevin and Donna have said when you've been talking to them, the reality is that Vermonters are not being able to meet their basic needs. And, of course, folks do have vehicles, but the reality is that Vermonters need vehicles to get around. We're a rural state, and until we have real transportation reform, that's going to be something they have to have.
Our number is 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211. Trevin is on the line from Middlesex. Hi, Trevin.
Hi. Yeah, I wanted to ask a question about how things are going in the last few years, because both my impression and the numbers that I see suggest that the typical paycheck for working Vermonters, I don't mean the average because wealthy people have been doing really well, but has actually been declining. It's been shrinking. And I just took a look at the numbers. Since 2002, at least according to the state of Vermont, everyone who was earning less than $65,000 in 2002 is actually making less today than they were, 4 or 5 years ago. And so I don't see that everyone is doing well in Vermont. It seems like people at the top are doing really well, but the majority of us, our incomes are actually declining. And now with inflation picking up, looks like a softening economy and rising unemployment, I don't see any reason to think that if we just leave all of this to Art Wolf's face and some kind of invisible hand, that things are going to get better. It seems like we've got to change policies.
Well, Trevin,
I hear your response on that.
Yeah, I thank you for the call. And Art Wolf, Trevin brings up some interesting points. And, the median household income in Vermont only grew 8% from 1990 to 2006. And the cost of living does seem to be going higher than that. So do you have any economic data to back up what Trevin
sure.
is saying?
The median family in Vermont, the difference between a household and a family is what we all know as a family. A household can be one person by themselves. It could be two unrelated people, or it could be a family. If we look at the average family in Vermont, or the median family, the one right in the middle of the income distribution, half earn more and half earn less, they earn about $62,000 a year. That number's been crawling upward slowly for the last 4 or 5 years. It kind of peaked in 1999 before the last recession, and it's grown slowly. We're about back to that level. There's no doubt that growth has been slow, but we're back to where we were. So the vast majority of people are doing okay. And so I think that there's this misnomer that there's all these people down at the bottom of the income distribution. And there are people who earn low wages, but we have to also differentiate between wages and income. a vast majority of the people who earn low wages live in families or households that have relatively higher middle class income. Teenagers, for example, are one class of people. So you have to be very careful about policies that you want to choose to deal with the problem of poverty, and don't have them lead to unanticipated consequences where you end up making other problems worse.
Well, explain that a little bit. What are you talking about?
Yeah. Well, the livable wage, for example, is a real good one. I mean, basically, the livable wage campaign says no matter who you are, no matter where you work, you should make $14 an hour. Now, that's fine for people who are trying to support themselves or support a family or a child. That we should do all we can to try to help those people, and there are programs to help those people. But there's very little or there's no logic to having a teenager who lives in a household that's earning $60,000, $70,000, or $80,000 working at McDonald's or in a grocery store to make $14 an hour, because that's just going to cause prices to go up in the grocery store and prices to go up at McDonald's. And it's going to be the low-income people who patronize those stores are going to pay those higher prices so that middle-income teenagers can have higher wages. So if you're going to raise wages, what you need to do is you need to have a very targeted approach to raise the wages only of those people who really need it. And we do have, as I said, we have programs in place that do just that.
Colin Robinson, I saw you shaking your head a minute ago.
Yeah, you know, I think that, first of all, we would never advocate changing and increasing every wage earner in Vermont to a livable wage overnight. That of course would not be the way to do it. What I think is most important is recognizing why does the livable wage keep going up? It keeps going up because housing costs are going up. It's incredibly difficult to purchase an affordable house in Vermont, let alone rent. Fuel costs are going up. You know, fuel, transportation, and Vermonters are having to drive. Especially in rural communities, and a gallon of gas is over $3.
But what about Art Wolf's contention that if you raise the minimum wage, then you're raising prices for low-income consumers as well?
My understanding is that hasn't been the case. Where they've raised the minimum wage, it hasn't, you know, priced Vermonters out of their ability to afford different goods. And, you know, I think the reality is that when folks, you know, are in jobs that don't allow them to meet their basic needs, it creates it has effects on all of us as members of society. And, you know, we need to create a kind of a social infrastructure and invest in some of these cost drivers in the basic needs budget. You know, healthcare is another one. And childcare. Childcare is incredibly expensive. And working parents, you know, two working parents having to put a child into childcare, that's a very, very expensive cost. And if we're able to invest in these areas, we can create good paying jobs, and we can create a situation where folks are actually able to make wages that allow them to meet their basic needs by lowering the cost of basic needs.
Well, Art Wolf, I want to go back to what you said a minute ago, and I have a couple of questions for you. First of all, what's wrong with raising the minimum wage so that, yes, teenagers are making more, but the people who need to make more are also making more? You know, we're making sure that those at the lower end of the income bracket are making more, and maybe an added benefit to those teenagers.
Well, the minimum wage or livable wage is a very blunt instrument to accomplish a goal. What you want to do is have a very targeted instrument that only targets the people that you want to help, because firms are going to respond in a number of ways if their wages that they have to pay go up. Number one is they may just hire fewer people, in which case the opportunities for people that don't have a whole lot of skills, and most of the people that earn low wages either because they're very young or because they have low skills. They are high school dropouts, or they're maybe a high school graduate, but they don't have many marketable skills, so there's not a whole lot of jobs available for them. So what you want to do is you want to make sure that you don't have a lot of unanticipated consequences of this very blunt instrument, such as not having as many opportunities, such as having prices go up for people that low-income people. And as I said, we do have programs. The Earned Income Tax Credit is probably one of the best ones. We have health care programs for people who don't have health care. If you're poor, you get Medicaid. If you're poor and you can't afford food, you get food stamps. And those are very targeted programs which deal with very specific needs for people that are at the low end of the income level.
So you don't think that we need to mandate wages necessarily?
No, I think it's counterproductive. And not only that, but if, I mean, why stop at $14 an hour? It'd be nice if everybody made $50,000 from their job. So why don't we just raise the livable wage to $25 an hour? And I think the consequence of that would be obvious to everybody. Firms would say, well, we can't afford to pay all our employees that level. And, you know, we'd have all sorts of unanticipated consequences that would be very obvious to any economist or anybody who thought about it.
We have a caller. Jose is on the line from Barnett. Hi, Jose.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I've been listening with increasing interest and, well, a little bit of chagrin at the intellectualizing and getting so involved in statistics and approaches that, you know, are certainly an integral part of solutions, but the more basic solution has to do with dealing with people who are having to face the realities of not having income that can provide not only food, but if they have housing, if they're fortunate to have it, to deal with emergencies, to deal with so many things that present themselves in such a way that people are caught unprepared, and in so many cases they're often put out on the street. Social organizations that are trying to provide help are taxed to the rafters.
Jose, what would you like to see happen? What would help, do you think?
Well, I would like at this point to see more dedicated to helping people acquire skills to survive, how to make do with less. Instead of going to McDonald's, like the gentleman was talking about, get that bag of pasta for a couple of dollars and feed a family of six. Basic, very fundamental things that I'm sorry, but they do get overlooked. And eventually, you know, you have to come back to these things because they won't go away.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jose, thank you very much for the call. I appreciate it. Colin Robinson, Jose mentioned job training. Are you working on that? And do you think that's one way to combat the problems of people living at the margins?
Yeah, I mean, it's something that is being talked about, and there's a lot of conversation about it. But recognizing that by focusing on workforce development, it is a way to provide people with skills that are able to provide them with jobs that will meet their basic needs. And you know, I think that is I think that's very, very important in recognizing that, you know, liberal arts college education isn't necessarily what everybody wants or what is going to be most marketable for everybody, and recognizing that there are some very important trades, you know, plumbing, carpentry, automobile repair, that can't be outsourced. You know, those jobs are never going to be outsourced. But I also want to I want to address one point that was mentioned. And, you know, I think that Jose said that, you know, we can't talk about these in abstractions. You know, the reality is, you know, the working poor in Vermont, the missing class, these folks between 100 and 300% of the federal poverty limit that are working very hard and not making ends meet, and talking about the real tangibles and recognizing that a lot of low-wage workers do have marketable skills. Like Donna Olson on the radio this morning, she has a bachelor's degree. She, you know, she has education. And, you know, recognizing that a lot of these folks are working very, very hard. And the final point I just want to make is that recognizing by paying a livable wage, and, you know, I would, as I said before, never advocate an immediate shot right up to a livable wage, but recognizing that this can benefit employers as well. And, you know, by addressing some of these cost drivers, energy costs, those are costs that employers deal with. Healthcare costs, those are costs that employers deal with. And by addressing some of those, we can help both businesses and the people that make up our state. And also, when employers pay a livable wage, there's greater retention rate, and they have employees that are more committed and more productive.
All right, Wolf, I want to give you a chance to respond.
Yeah, Jose had a very good point when he talked about skills, and that is vitally important. Our economy nowadays demands people with skills. If you don't have skills, you're not going to get a good wage. And that's why a very depressing statistic, if I may throw one other one out, is that about 12% of all the kids in Vermont drop out of high school. That's much better than the U.S. average, which is about 30%. Those are the people who are going to be earning low wages. And so what we need to do is make sure those people do stay in school and do get some skills. Everybody doesn't need a college degree, that's for sure. But it's vitally important that people do get their skills.
So job training is one of the solutions that you see to this problem?
Well, first of all, keep them in high school. But yes, job training, both of those are very, very important in terms of fundamental solutions to the problem.
What else? I mean, if you don't see the minimum wage or creating a livable wage as a solution to the problem, what do you think we should do?
Well, Vermont has a long history of being very innovative in this. And we've got we're one of the first states to piggyback the federal earned income tax credit. And what that is basically it's a supplement to people's wages if they are trying to survive on low-wage jobs. And at the federal level, the earned income tax credit can amount to $3,000 or $4,000. And Vermont's is one-third of the federal. We have one of the most liberal earned income tax credits in the country. And so someone who's making a low wage isn't just making their wage. They're getting supplemented by the federal and the state government to the tune of sometimes up to $5,000. So you don't just see the wage. You see that as well.
Well, I'd like to thank both of you for coming on today and talking about this issue. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Colin Robinson is the director of the Vermont Livable Wage Campaign, and Art Wolf is an associate professor of economics at the University of Vermont. Coming up, we'll put a face to some of the issues we've just been discussing. We'll talk with a woman from Pownall who knows firsthand what a livable wage means.
I wouldn't say I'm living comfortably. I've lived comfortably for a short while, and this isn't living comfortably. This is cutting corners everywhere I can.
This is Vermont Edition.
Volunteering for the VPR Pledge Drive is an experience that keeps people coming back.
There's great people to work with. We're doing good things for the station.
I've spoken to some rather famous people, authors, former governors, presidential candidates.
I find the folks that volunteer here to have a superior sense of humor.
It's just fun to thank people for their contributions and support of VPR.
Put a little fun in your life. Volunteer today for VPR's next Pledge Drive. Log on to VPR.net and click on Support VPR.
Vermont Edition is supported in part by the Lintelac Foundation and by Ohana Family Camp on Vermont's Lake Fairlie, making family memories for over 100 years, ohanacamp.org. And City Market Burlington, with local meat, fresh seafood, and groceries to suit all tastes. Open 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. This is VPR, Vermont Public Radio.
You're listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. We've been talking about what it takes to make a living here in Vermont. Now we're going to hear from some people who are struggling to get by. Carol McLean lives in Pownall. She makes a little over $10 an hour as a full-time driver for Green Mountain Community Network in Bennington. She has three children. One is still living at home, and she's been struggling to get them the best education possible. McLean has worked for a number of jobs, retail and secretarial, but she says this one that she's in now is one of the better ones. Carol McLean joins us now. And Carol, can you tell us a little bit about the work you do and why you like it?
Well, I drive for the Green Mountain Express, and basically we help people get to their medical appointments. We help the elderly and low income. It's fulfilling because, you know, especially helping out the elderly, sometimes we're the only people they see. I picked up a woman, and she says, I haven't been out of my house in a month. Hmm. So, I mean, just that, you know, we're actually there for them, and you feel good helping them.
What about for you? Would you say you're living comfortably right now?
No, I would put it more as I'm surviving. You definitely turn your thermostat down in the winter. You know, at night, it's not above 62 degrees. Especially with the price of gas, I really have to limit how many trips I make, you know, to make sure I have enough to get to work and maybe one trip during the weekend. If I do more than that, it cuts me short for the week.
So it's a constant struggle between what you can afford and what you can't afford.
Yes, it is. It definitely is. And there's, you know, a lot of people out there that are in the same situation.
Do you get any assistance from food stamps or energy assistance?
When my children were younger, I would apply for food stamps. As they got older, I found it more difficult to go down and ask for help. One of the reasons was you got talked down to a lot. It, like you weren't doing enough to support yourself, and I just couldn't handle that anymore. So the only thing I did was keep applying for medical assistance because I didn't have any to where I was working at that time. And, you know, with children, you really need some kind of medical coverage.
Is it any easier now that your children are older and you can live more independently?
You would think it would be, but with inflation, it really hasn't gotten any easier. You know, my youngest son, I'm trying to get him back into college. He had to drop out because of finances. And he's working, trying to save. And I'm still paying on a parent loan, and he's still paying on student loans from when he was in school. And he wants to get back in school, and I want him back in school. It's something I've always pushed my children to do, to go to a higher education. And my daughter did graduate from college. My oldest son went for 2 years and dropped out. And now I have my youngest son trying to get back in.
When you think about their lives, what do you want for your children to have?
Definitely better than what I have and what I've been able to give them. I don't want it to be a struggle for them.
Do you think it will be?
I'd say my daughter is definitely doing better than I've ever done. And, you know, she does have a bachelor's degree, so that definitely helps. My oldest son, it's somewhat of a struggle for him, but he's very smart and inventive, and I think he's going to do okay. And my youngest son, I really think he needs to get that degree, that college degree.
Do you think that having more money when they were growing up would have made a difference?
In a lot of ways, yes, although I see some that have no respect for anything because they've had everything handed to them. One thing I say about my children, they do have respect. They know what hard work is about, and they're not afraid of it. And, I mean, I have instilled some good things in them.
What do you think the biggest misconception is about people who have trouble making ends meet?
I think that most people see it as people just starting out, that they can't do it. But, unfortunately, it's not that way. It goes from the young to the elderly. There's a lot of people out there struggling.
And you mentioned when you went down when your children were younger to get food stamps, you encountered stereotypes against people like you.
Yeah, it is. And even when you had to use the food stamps in the stores, you were embarrassed to use them. And after a while, you don't want to do that to yourself or your children because, you know, you start to feel like you actually aren't trying hard enough. And you could be working two jobs, which I've done a lot. I've worked two part-time jobs. I've worked a full-time job and a part-time job at the same time. At one point, I even worked two full-time jobs.
And you've told stories about attempts to try to pay your bills and getting into some trouble with credit cards.
Yes. Well, I think there's millions of other Americans out there that have done the same thing. You know, I had to borrow against my credit card to pay my bills because my unemployment ran out. And, you know, I had to make my car payments, pay my rent, and, you know, everything. And then you do what other people have done. I know there's people that I work with done this. You take one credit card that offers you, if you transfer a balance, you get 0% interest. So you start doing that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, then you end up with, like, three credit cards you're trying to pay off. So I'm trying to pay off three credit cards plus the parent loan.
Do you think things are getting better or getting worse?
Oh, definitely getting worse.
Why is that?
Well, inflation, the price of, you know, the oil, which affects everything. You know, once those prices go up, you know the price of everything else is going to go up. And you know, your wages don't go up to meet those demands.
So what do you think needs to happen?
Well, I think a good start would be with some of the CEOs of the companies who demand these big salaries and brand new cars every year and then lay off the people that are helping them make the money. And with health care, the same thing, the hospitals. Their main concern should be the patients. And instead, it seems like the administration's making these ridiculous salaries and they're laying off nurses and cutting down on the health care. That doesn't make any sense. And, well, you see that everywhere. I think that is getting worse. It's like this whole nation is being run on greed.
So if there could be more balance between the lowest paid employees and the CEOs?
Yeah, more appreciation, I'd say, for the working class.
How do you keep going and keep your kids' spirits up when it's such a struggle to just maintain a life?
Oh, well, I mean, sometimes I get depressed, but my youngest son, I'm trying to get back in college. He's very smart, mm-hmm. and he knows he needs that education. You know, all my children knew that. I just basically tell them that they can do it and they need to do it, and, you know, I will help them out any way that I can.
Carol McLean, I want to thank you very much for talking to us today. I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Carol McLean is a driver for Green Mountain Community Network in Bennington. She lives in Pownal. It's been pointed out that the definition of a living wage can vary depending on each worker's needs and hopes and circumstances. As part of our series, Getting By, VPR's Nina Keck spoke with Steve Leonard. He's a 24-year-old bottle sorter at Beer King in Rutland, and he says he's satisfied, at least for now, with both the work and the compensation.
I'm Steve Leonard from Rutland, Vermont. Yeah, I've been doing this about 2.5 years.
This is sorting cans and bottles at the Redemption Center behind the Beer King in Rutland. When I ask him what his official job title is, he hesitates for a minute, then breaks into a big smile.
I guess it's a bottle redemptionist. As far as what the other kids write on the wall over here, they tend to get a little creative.
He walks around several bins of bottles and cans to where black graffiti provides a bit of historical perspective on the position.
Yeah, I guess I'm a redemptionist because it says Hail Betsy, goddess of the redemptionists. I don't know who Betsy is. I don't know how that came into the picture. Well, a typical day is going to be starting somewhere around 11 a.m.
If it's a busy day, Steve will sort hundreds, if not thousands, of cans and bottles. His gloved fingers move quickly, tearing open plastic bags, dumping, sorting, throwing, dumping, sorting, throwing. It's like a dance that he does with his hands.
Practice makes perfect. 424.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, I feel this is a job where I'm being paid adequately. There's nothing unreasonable asked of me. You finish up for the day and you don't have to take anything home with you. It's not, you know, I'm never going to have a headache over something, really. So I'm pretty happy with it.
Steve isn't married and doesn't have any kids to support. He's 24 years old, lives by himself a few blocks from work, and doesn't own a car. He makes less than $12 an hour, but says it's enough to cover his expenses.
I do have another part-time job that I can get hours if I want to. That does help.
But what about health insurance?
I don't have health insurance right now.
Is that a concern?
A lot of people tell me it should be, but I tend to disagree. I might be still stuck in that invincible teenager mentality. I don't know.
Steve Leonard says one of these days, when he needs to, he'll get around to checking out his options on health insurance. But not now. He says he'd also like to go to college someday, but he's not sure how he'd pay for it. Travel is another dream. But Leonard doesn't seem to be in any hurry. He likes the fact that he's helping people do something environmentally friendly, like recycle. Standing behind the counter at the Redemption Center, he looks relaxed and content.
This job has taught me, you might not think, you know, what you're doing is important, but I think in any job, the important thing is just to be there on time and keep your eyes open.
When you work with the public, he says, you never know what you're going to see. Maybe someone's car breaks down, he says, or something worse happens. You have to be ready, says Leonard, to jump in and lend a hand. For VPR News, I'm Nina Keck in Rutland.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's our program for today. You'll find more links and comments on low-wage work on our website, vpr.net. You can post your own comments there as well. And be sure to listen all this week to Morning Edition for more stories of Vermonters getting by. The Eye on the Sky comprehensive forecast is next, followed by The Story with Dick Gordon. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Steve Zind, Sarah Ashworth, and Susan Keyes, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Rick Singeri directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. I'm Jane Lindholm. I hope you have a great afternoon. Thanks for listening. We welcome feedback and suggestions for Vermont Edition. Contact us anytime at vpr.net.